You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
So has it been 2 years since you got a haircut?
Sort of. I have had a couple of trims, but obviously I've not had a proper normal haircut in 2 years. Yeah, it's 2 years.
So right now, I feel like I'm talking to Trent Crimmer, the Independent, on Ted Lasso.
Well, he's a journalist, right? So, yes. You know, maybe that's, I hear a lot. He got fired.
He got fired for, you know, not respecting a source.
Yeah, there were some circumstances, though, right? I forget the details, but
let's not do spoilers again, so other folks are still catching up.
I hear people say I look like a lot of different people. There's you know, and mostly it's you know, heavy metal rock star of a certain age kind of thing.
So I feel like you're past heavy metal now.
Wow, I've transcended.
Yeah. That. You're now just a journalist.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is cool. I'm up in the air on what to do. But obviously, you know, the feedback I get online is pretty universally negative. But I just think that's the nature. I can't trust that because that's the nature of trolls. And so
what's the verdict at home? That's the big question.
Well, I'm still married happily. My wife obviously is a veto. I mean, if she hated it, it would be gone 15 minutes ago. And so, you know, if she told me she didn't like it, so lobby her, people. If you don't like it, lobby her. But I will say, Bill, I mean, it has been an interesting sort of sociological thing. You know, you don't realize, I was just listening to this cool podcast, you know, Dana Carvey and David Spade have a podcast about SNL, and they had Rob Lowe was a guest recently, and Rob Lowe was saying he went to a restaurant and he was like in makeup to make himself look fat and older. And he was actually dressed like in a police uniform. He was like on a movie shoot and he went to a nice restaurant. And the people didn't treat him so well. You know, the restaurant, the owner or whatever, treated him like a schlub. And I sort of know how that feels now a little bit. Like you get, when you have like long hair, you get treated a little different than like, I used to walk around looking like a young Republican, you know, like walking around in D.C.
In the world your oyster, you look like a Republican.
Yeah. And I mean, the funny thing is, even in D.C., where there are a ton of progressives, it's a very conservative looking. People dress very conservative. So I now know what it's like to be on the wrong side of that divide.
Well, I remember when I was 15, 16, I grew my hair out over the summer before 10th grade. Which wasn't meant to really be a big protest statement. I just sort of concluded, you know what? I think I look better with my hair grown out. And as soon as I got into school, people were like, are you smoking marijuana now?
Yeah. I think that there is, you know, people attribute things, drugs, leftism. You're a hippie. All sorts of things. And I mean, I do feel it a little bit, like that people are judging me.
But is it self-fulfilling? Are you now a left-wing hippie? Do you find yourself hanging out with the stoners under the bleachers?
No, I'm, you know, I'm just a fuzzy little teddy bear, you know, fuzzball. But no, it is weird. And I find people following me around jewelry stores. Not really, but it does give you a taste of you know, the how society judges people and treats people differently. This is why I always dress up when I fly. You know, when you're on an airplane, you should dress up not only because of a thing we call, you know, society, as George Will would tell you. But you'll get treated better if you dress up and like wear a suit. So that's one of the things that I'm learning.
So I do want to talk to you about something very pressing, perhaps the most consequential decision made by the United States Senate in the past few years, and that is the bill to make daylight savings time permanent.
Yes.
Which I guess it wasn't done in the dark of night, but was done with minimal debate.
Now, is this, am I correct that Rubio is the chief proponent of this? I know it's bipartisan, but.
Yeah, I think he is, I don't know if he's the lead sponsor,
you know,
but he's
like just
a lead
when
sponsor.
I think he can't get any lower. He goes out.
So you're anti.
What's that?
You're anti permanent daylight savings time?
No, I say he goes out and totally redeems himself.
Oh, I see.
On the Dumb and Dumber thing. No, I support this. And I got to tell you, man, I don't know about you. I feel really weird right now. So if I say crazy stuff, it's not the long hair or the marijuana talking. It's I don't know.
It's not the hair talking.
It was like 63 degrees on Friday. Then on Saturday, it was 18 degrees and we got like 6 inches of snow. Mm. And now it's 73 degrees. It's been crazy weather changes, crazy time change. And now we're, I mean, it messes you all up. I don't know if it's the NyQuil talking. I don't know if it's allergy season. I feel really weird. And I think when you throw an hour time change at people, particularly those who have animals and children, it takes a toll. I'm sure that there's like more car accidents and heart attacks and all sorts of things that happen every twice a year when our government throws this at us, right?
I don't know the statistics around it. All I know is I can't get my children to bed in the summer when it's light out after 8:30 p.m. And so I have hated daylight savings time.
Oh, you don't like daylight savings time.
I hate the change.
Yeah, I hate the change.
I hate the change, but I would change it all back to standard time, yeah, not to daylight savings time.
No, that's where you're wrong, Bill. I have, in the past week, I have played catch with my boys two or three nights where after dinner, you know, work is over, school is over, and it's still a little bit light out, and we'll go out and we'll play catch and we'll have that time together. I can't do that at 6 a.m. That happens at...
You're telling me that in the spring and summer, you would not play catch outside for the same amount of time if you're on standard time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't care. I'm not going to do anything at 6 a.m. I'm not going to play catch with my kids at 6 a.m. I'm not going to
I'm not actually doing the front end. I'm saying I suspect people would do the same amount of stuff in the evening in the spring and summer with or without daylight savings.
No, because it would be dark at 6 o'clock right now, as opposed to 7 o'clock or whatever. I mean,
but you're on the front. I mean, we're not even quite at spring yet.
Sure.
You know, yeah. I mean, once we get into like April, May, June, July.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, there's a tipping point where, you know, maybe it's May, but that's a month and a half from now. I think you're right. Eventually, you know, we're going to be adding daylight and
I mean, the weather's still a little touchy in a lot of places in the country. We're just starting like here in New England, like this week's a pretty good weather week, but we'll probably have a backslide. We'll probably get some snow before, you know, the end of March is out, early April. We usually get one less bit of winter.
No, I'm not exaggerating. It was like 63 degrees, then 18 degrees and 6 inches of snow, and then 73 degrees. Like, it's been bizarre. And I, you know, if it was rainy and snowy, I wouldn't be out. But, you know, I feel like having more light in the evening, like, at 6 a.m., I have to get up and go to work or go to school. That's crappy anyway. But I want to enjoy the nice evenings of sunshine.
We are going to have mornings, you know, in the colder months,
yeah,
where kids are going to school in the pitch dark.
I'm okay with that.
I mean,
there's always a trade-off. There's always a trade-off, right? Because here's the thing, and people say like, yeah, well, we don't want kids like waiting for the bus in the dark. And I'm like, okay, but they get off school in the dark sometimes in the winter. Like there are times.
I'll tell you one thing. If there is one incident of a school bus hitting a kid in the dark in the morning, that's going to cause a lot of rethinking about this plan.
It might, but that would be, I think, a case of not thinking logically, because again, school buses drive in the dark, you know, in the evenings. In fact, I would say that there are times in the winter, you know, during standard time, when kids go to school in the dark and come home in the dark. I mean, depending on, you know, what time the school gets out. So anyway, but here's the thing where I think we can agree.
Okay.
Let's quit changing. Like,
I'm anti-changing. Let's quit changing,
but let's pick a side, pick a time.
I definitely agree with that. I prefer, you know, all daylight savings to the switch.
Yeah.
I hate the switch.
Yeah. And I think now, okay, apparently this goes back to farming. Like there was a reason for this. I don't fully understand the reason, I'll be honest with you, but there was a reason having to do with efficiency and conservation, and I think farming of energy conservation. Do you have any?
I don't know the backstory.
Knowledge.
I've not done the deep dive on it.
Okay. Because I think there was a rationale at some point for why we started this. Let's be honest, insane idea. Otherwise, it's crazy. Because look, humans, our biorhythms and body clocks, it will mess you up, man. You know, if you, we see it happen when we travel, you know, with the time zones. So,
I don't know, not speaking from any expert place of expertise here. I mean, certainly as a nation, we don't get outside exercise enough. We all know that. We're also very sleep deprived. I don't know how this is going to help on the sleep deprivation front if you're pushing things back all the time. I mean, if you're staying out late, are you then backloading your screen time and staying up too late scrolling on screens and getting less sleep? I don't know if it's going to shake out that way or not. But from my parental vantage point, I am constantly battling to get my kids enough sleep.
Yeah,
and because they want to push their bedtimes back all the time, and this always makes things harder.
Yeah, although if it doesn't change, I think part of what makes it harder is that it changes. You know, in other words, if this was the new normal, you would have to find a way to kind of consistently.
I mean, the change is always a little bit awkward, like that those days, like, you know, just after. But I mean, the bigger issue is just like in the summer where. I mean, look, if I have kids that, I mean, and there will be days like this, this particular summer, where they don't have a camp, they don't have anything scheduled, and they want to sleep in, who cares? So I'm going to have more days like that this year than past years, because they're kind of growing out of camp.
See, I'm sort of a Nazi about bedtime. So
I swear to you, Matt.
I believe it. Look, all these people who don't have kids, and then they think, oh, well, I would just make them do this. Or, you know, they're like, okay, this is what someone says who doesn't have kids. You know what I mean?
I mean, sleep is the thing where I'm really mad at how things turned out, because it was like the one thing I thought I did right. I really had some very hard lines about sleep, and you know, I had them on good routines for a good long while. And it's like all been obliterated. Multiple, you know, one, just them just agitating to stay up longer and, you know, having their tantrums and whatnot. You know, wanting to have TV time with parents, you know, my wife's out of the house more. So like that's sort of time that she has with them. So she wants to have that time.
Yeah. Parenthood's super hard.
The pandemic totally screwed everything up royally as far as sleep patterns are concerned. Just how all the anxieties, you know, exploded and getting them to go to sleep and stay asleep all got trashed.
You know, I'm obviously kind of a natalist, politically speaking, but being a parent, super hard. It takes a real toll on your life and your career. And I think there are certainly benefits and trade-offs, but it's a heavy lift. You know, it's not for wimps.
You need Scared Straight videos before parenthood. Like this is what you're signing up for.
Well, see, like, I don't want to discourage parenthood because I'm like, I think that, so I think, you know, more people is more ideas and more people are generally good. I'm up with people. But also, you know, I think that as a conservative, having kids is a civilizing force on society. I mean, the way that the world look, like my calculations about the world and what I want the world to look like would be different if I were single, you know, versus if you have kids, you start thinking about like long-term things and it does change your worldview for a lot of people.
I don't feel more civilized by being a parent. I feel emotionally savage by being a parent. And I can't even like put in the headspace to think about broader. I mean, it's amazing I get anything done professionally because like so much of my day is just how do I get through the day? I don't even think about like broader societal implications
money
of
too.
My parenting.
Dude, money. My kid, you know, he plays piano, and there's a really cool app. That, you know, he had me sign up for temporarily. And of course, because I'm doing a million other things, I forget to unsubscribe after the month trial and I get billed like $150. Now, it turns out this app is actually worthwhile. I'm glad we got it. $150 I wasn't expecting. He volunteered himself to they're studying Egypt. And so he's making some sort of food. He spent like $30 yesterday at a grocery store buying sirloin or something. That, you know what I mean? It's like the money adds up. I mean, money that you would otherwise not spend. Mm-hmm. Also just control of your house, cleanliness. Do you know what it's like to have an 11-year-old and a 9-year-old boy? I mean, it's like living with like John Belushi or something. I mean, like
girls aren't much better.
I can only imagine. I mean, I assume they are, but I'm telling you, it's a frat house here. And now like my wife very much wants things to be, she's very like ordered and she likes things. She likes to manage things. Mm-hmm. And these kids are like, it's just chaos. Mm-hmm. And it's money. It's emotional bandwidth. Dude, you and I need like a guys. Let's just like hit the road, man. You and I, just bail.
This is why guys do hit the road and don't come back.
I mean, that used to happen all the time. I had, you know, David, our friend David Petruja, the historian, told me that like in the olden days, it used to happen all the time that men would just disappear.
Yeah.
Like, and they were usually married men with kids, and they would just up and leave, and no one could track them down. And there's a famous story about this woman's like, she lived in Ohio or something, they had 2 or 3 kids, and her husband goes missing, and she's like watching a movie one day, and her husband's like an actor in the movie. He like went to Hollywood, and that's how they tracked him down. But men used to just disappear, and they didn't know, like, was he kidnapped? Did he die? Did he run off with the circus? But they would just up and leave.
Well, we have managed to delay talking about Ukraine for a solid 20 minutes, which I think is impressive on our part. Yeah,
that's a record.
We've made the world safe to talk about other things that are not Ukraine. But it still is obviously the dominant issue. It's still painful to see what's going on.
I think Zelensky is addressing Congress as we tape this.
Yeah. And, you know, our portfolio only allows us to talk about crass political things.
Let's be honest. We both could speak very eloquently and credibly about the geopolitical nature of this, but because of our mandate here at Blogging Heads, they would like us to stick to, you know, just sort of rank punditry.
I saw some social media meme about, you know, I was a covert expert yesterday, but I'm a foreign policy expert today.
Yes.
So we'll try very hard not to, you know, fall into that trap. But I do think that, and I wrote a piece about this for the Washington Monthly. I mean, wars have the potential to spark political realignment. And, you know, it's not just, you know, a horse race thing. I mean, what the parties stand for foreign policy wise has great impact on the world, especially when it's a country like America, which is a superpower. But you look at, you can go back to the War of 1812. The War of 1812, like, extinguishes the Federalist Party. You know, it existed before the war. It didn't exist after the war because they were too sympathetic to the British. The Mexican-American War, you know, elevates slavery as an issue, because slavery expansion was an issue, which destroys the Whig Party, and the Republican Party is created out of the ashes of the Whig Party. And you look at the World Wars, you know, America becomes, the Democratic Party becomes internationalist as a result of Wilson's entry into World War I, kicking William Jennings Bryan to the curb, who was more of an isolationist. And World War II, the Republicans had become kind of isolationist and then gravitated being internationalists because...
Not only that, then we out-hawked your ass.
That's Vietnam. I mean, you know, you have, Democrats were the party in charge getting us into World War I and World War II and Korea. Truman designs containment out of World War II. Combination of Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson that get us into Vietnam, but Johnson's the one that, you know, cranks it up high. And the Democratic Party's revulsion of how Vietnam turned out turns a good chunk of the party dovish. And you already had the makings of a harder edged anti-communist wing of the Republican Party with McCarthyism in the 50s, saying that the Trumanites were being too soft, even though they did containment. So those tectonic plates were shifting.
Yeah.
And then post-Vietnam, and this is most of our lifetimes, you think of the Republicans as hawks and Democrats as doves. It's very simplistic.
Yeah. And let me just, I'm going to expound on that, because you've just, ever since Trump came along, I've been grappling with, like, what happened to the Republican Party? Was Trump, you know, an anomaly? Was Trump the inevitable outcome of the Republican Party? I mean, all these things. Yeah, I wrote a book that went into a lot of this. But I've been wrestling with this for so long. And I think I've really come to the conclusion that my perception was skewed by virtue of my age. Which is to say, there was a weird anomaly where the Republican Party and conservatism was sort of a Reagan party. And it just happened to coincide from about the time I was born until 2016. Mm-hmm. So I think you could look at Donald Trump actually as not being the anomaly. You could argue he is somewhat a continuation of where the party was going before Pearl Harbor.
Well, I mean, I'm using these terms a little loosely. People get twitchy when you say things like isolationist. So I'm not trying to use it in the most pejorative sense, but just for lack of, you know, precise
America language, first.
Well, I mean, America First was literally a thing that came out of, you know, the rupture of World War II. Charles Lindbergh, Gerald Ford was America Firster. I mean, these are folks that did not want to get involved in a European war, and Lindbergh was a Nazi sympathizer.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, and not to put too fine a point on it, but the post-Cold War, the Republican Party, like, during the Cold, because the Cold War was the glue that held together the conservative movement. You know, economic conservatives hated Marxism, communism, fiscal conservatives, you know, same thing. Social conservatives hated the godless, atheistic communists. National security conservatives obviously had their reason to not like the Soviet Union. You had that, and then throw in Reagan and Kemp and that vibe. That was the anomaly. Like,
yeah,
most of my life has my perception of the conservative. So my perception of the conservative movement and the Republican Party was colored by what I think was actually the exception.
I would phrase it a little differently, because, you know, the Republican Party trajectory on this is very zigzaggy. And, you know, you go back to, you know, McKinley, Republican. You know, McKinley was reluctant to get into the Spanish, what became the Spanish-American War. It's Teddy Roosevelt that was really banging the war drum, and not just him solely. I mean, there was a real jingoistic fervor, you know, after the Maine exploded. And I really think, you know, outside of 9/11, you really can't find a similar time when the country had that much bloodlust. You know, most of the time, Americans are reluctant to go in. I mean, leaders might be another story, but like the American people have generally been like, hey, the cool thing about America is that it's all happening over there. We don't got to get involved. And, you know, politicians can do things to try to push people into accepting it, but it tends to be work. Spanish-American War was a time when, like, it was a bottom-up. The president didn't want to do it and was really pushed into it. But Teddy Roosevelt was, like, a straight-up, unabashed, warmongering imperialist. Like, he had no, like, he gave blunt, pro-imperialistic speeches, unvarnished. No, he did not shade his views in any respect. And he become, you know, and so McKinley Roosevelt Republicanism, you know, is a hawkish and regressive. But Wilson, leaning heavily into the League of Nations, and with that and the end of that war, not really embraced by the American public. It was seen as kind of an awkward and ambiguous ending. League of Nations, you know, the Treaty of Versailles doesn't get ratified, and Harding runs against League of Nations. The Democrats, you know, tried to stick with it and got hammered. So those 1920s Republicans, you know, Harding, Coolidge, you know, Hoover, are much more reluctant to get involved internationally. And Robert Taft becomes sort of Mr. Isolationist for a good long stretch. And then that starts changing, with McCarthyism, bringing up that anti-communist faction of the party, and then Vietnam really turbocharging Republican hawkishness. So it's a complicated.
Yeah. And it may just be that if you're looking for consistency or coherence in any political movement or party, then you're out of luck, because they're all based on reacting to things and taking advantage of opportunities and pragmatism and getting elected. So that may be a lesson. two quick things that you spark. One would be, it's not just where the party stands on dovishness versus hawkishness, but there were just so many demagogues, you know, in politics, including people like Joseph McCarthy. And then even people like, I won't call Pat Buchanan a demagogue, but like a populist nationalist, Ross Perot. I mean, he wasn't a Republican when he ran for president, but he fits into that theme. But they always, they never won. You know what I mean?
The isolationist Republicans, generally, the isolationists in both parties, going back to Spanish-American War, they exist in both parties. They've always existed in both parties, but they have rarely dominated both parties, either party. So Trump is anomalous in that respect, that America First. Now, and his brand of America First is, bound up in his Trump First mentality. So it's not a wholly intellectually consistent view. But generally speaking, he is someone who says, let us be friends with autocrats, and we will not care about any kind of international human rights standards. So we can do what we want and they can do what they want. And who cares about who gets hurt by it? I mean, that is essentially the upshot of the Trump view. And it speaks to a libertarian sense on the Republican side. And it speaks to a pacifist sense on the progressive side, at least elements of it. But Putin is such a monster that it's making it much harder to advocate for that kind of view.
Right. Well, that's what I was saying. Like, they say there's no atheists in foxholes. You know, I mean, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. I mean, everybody has a plan to be, you know, let's say, isolationist until they start seeing videos of kids getting blown up and pregnant women getting blown up. And then we'll see if you can stick to it. Like, the American public is so fickle. You know, the day before 9/11, terrorism probably wasn't that big of a deal in terms of public opinion. The day after 9/11, it suddenly is a big deal. And that's why we need leaders who will lead. And I think that obviously Donald Trump, captured the zeitgeist, but I don't think he was leading us in the right direction. The person obviously I'm a big Reagan fan. And I think that, you know, Charles Krauthammer wrote this piece in the 80s called The Reagan Doctrine. And the Reagan Doctrine was basically, after Vietnam, America, and I'm paraphrasing here, but everybody was chastened after Vietnam. So the strategy was, America will be a moral beacon of hope, and we will morally support and fund other people who want to fight, you know, these proxy wars against communism. But generally speaking, we're not going to do it ourselves. And I think that obviously worked. And I feel like Joe Biden, to his credit, in the last couple of months, has been emulating that sort of strategy.
Well, I mean, Biden is a bona fide internationalist and has never been a knee jerk dove. You know, he was more. You know, he leaned into Bush's Iraq war for a lot longer than most Democrats did, although. In recent years, he's blurred the lines about how far down the path he's willing to go. And he never was someone who was like lockstep with Bush. But he kind of wanted to be someone who was trying to steer that war in a better direction. And eventually, washed his hands of what the Bushes were doing. But he wasn't reflexively against it. And so in one sense, this... I think Politico had a piece about this. This is kind of, Biden's time. This is in Biden's wheelhouse to quarterback a crisis like this. You know, at the same time, one of the reasons why we do have pretty broad bipartisan support at home is that no one is really asking Americans to sacrifice all that much. No one's asking for American troops to go on the ground. No one's asking for, at least no one in America for the most part.
Yeah.
Asking for,
but I think that was part of Reagan's calculus too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's part of Reagan's,
Reagan did a few things that involved like direct military intervention, the Grenada thing, bombing Gaddafi. He went down that at Lebanon, which didn't go very well at all. Yes, right now Biden hasn't, you know, put U.S. troops in a new on a new front, and so this is the easiest way for Americans to support what's going on in Ukraine.
Yeah, no, let me stop you there though, because I'm not sure that that's right. Let's go back to the parent analogy. There's really two ways that are easy to parent. One is, be a jerk. Like, you're not nice. I'm not here to make friends. We have a strict lights out at 7:30 policy. And if you got a problem with that, come see me. You know what I mean? Like, hardline approach. Or you can try to be there. Let's watch TV. Oh, screen? Oh, yeah. Knock yourself out with screen time. Like, those are the two easy ways. Mm-hmm. Either be hardcore or be permissive. What's hard to do as a parent is to make judgment calls. Like, yeah, you could stay up late tonight because it's Halloween, but tomorrow night you have to be like, that's what's hard is. And so I think the world wants you to either be a strict, like, isolationist, or here's the dangerous part, to go all in. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to say, we're going to support Ukraine, but we're not going to do the no-fly zone. Because people are like, well, wait a second, you're willing to send them, you know, javelins, but mm-hmm. you're not willing to, you know, it's hard to do it a little bit, right?
Well,
Reagan did that. Mm-hmm. And I think so far, to his credit, and I've got a lot of criticism for Joe Biden, but talking about Ukraine, he has done that. And I think there's going to be a temptation for him to get sucked into more.
So you don't want him to do more.
No. Well, I mean, it depends what more is. Mm-hmm. But I think that he has to be strict about, we are going to support them morally, and we are providing them with weapons. We will not allow a situation where an American is in a conflict directly with Russians.
What happens if Russia goes into Poland?
I think that, Joe Biden has said that we will, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something effective, like, we will fight over every inch of NATO territory.
Which Poland is. You know, Ukraine is in Poland.
So that's not me. That's Biden's red line as he has stated it. Now, what if they actually do? This becomes very tricky, right? Because on one hand, personally, am I willing to die for Poland? But here's the other side of the coin. If that happens and America does not stand up and support its allies, every promise we've made is toast. If we can't support, you know, Article 5 of NATO, especially after Biden saying that we would. Now, if Trump gets elected, I wrote a column about this. Like, what this is the next question is, what if Trump gets elected? Then what? And I think that's a plausible, you know, possibility.
Let's not game that out just yet, because that's a couple years down the road. There's so many things that are going to happen between now and then. The harder question is, how far do we go if Russia escalates? And to your point, you know, we've already said, you know, we must help Ukraine. Putin can't win. We will defend every inch of NATO territory. So it's hard to walk. You climb down from that.
I think we have to. And to me, I think, because here's the deal. Not only are we sending a message to all of our allies and future allies about our word and commitment, we're also sending a message to Putin about appeasement and about future, where does he go next? And we're sending a message to China. So I think we have to defend every inch of NATO territory. Again, Ukraine is not in NATO.
Right.
And so, you know, the same rules do not apply. Sure. But I think we have to, God forbid, if they go there. And we would do it in a conventional manner, We can say that,
but what happens when Russia deploys a tactical nuclear weapon?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the, I mean,
that's how World War III
starts. I mean, I generally agree with everything you're saying.
That's how World War III starts.
But, I wrote a piece about Romney in Russia, which I want to get into because I think it does relate to everything that you're saying. But there was a piece that I got into in that piece about David Leonhardt's column in the Times, where he was chiding the way America and Europe handled Putin up to this point, essentially saying, you know, we displayed weakness and Putin thought he could walk all over us. And if we did what, you know, Bush did in 1990 with the Gulf War, the Bush senior, that would have been different. And he sort of mentioned, well, I do know it's different that, you know, Russia has nukes and Iraq didn't, but nevertheless, this shows that you had to be tough. And my reaction was, wait a second. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Like, we didn't stop Hussein from invading Kuwait. He was not deterred from invading Kuwait. He invaded. Then we were able to put together an international coalition and crush him. And we could do it with just brute military force without thinking twice because he did not have nuclear weapons. So we knew we could just beat him and be done with it. So what's different is not the deterrence part, because neither was deterred. The more challenging part is now, how do you respond to Putin militarily? Because he does have nukes. He has nuclear missiles.
Well, I do think it's
tactical nukes.
Yeah. So I think it does deter. Number one, Iraq didn't do it again. Number two.
After they lost or they were defeated
militarily. Sure. And I think it sends a message to other people, too, and other bad actors. But here's the thing. I think, my whole reason, I don't think we can't do a no-fly zone. And I'm with Biden on, Poland changing their mind about the MiGs. And, I'm supporting Biden here, mm-hmm. okay? I think Biden is walking the line, which I think he needs to do. It's the hardest thing in the world is to say, we're going to support them, but we're not – but I won't do that, as Meatloaf might say. Mm-hmm. So I support what Biden is doing, and there's going to be a big temptation for him to be drawn in. And what I'm saying is, if World War III is to start – let's not do it stupid. Let it not be. Let it not happen because we got accidentally sucked in or, you know. But there are things worth dying for. And if having a nuclear weapon means that everyone, when push comes to shove, everyone will back down to you, then it's all over anyway. I mean, because this is a, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I don't want to stupidly or, you know, accidentally slip into a nuclear exchange. We have to be very prudent, very careful. And I think Biden, to his credit so far, is doing that. When it comes to if Putin now, having seen what we've done in Ukraine and having seen what we have said, if he invades Poland, I mean, if we just say, okay, have at it, you know, what can we do? You guys have nuclear weapons. What can we do? Where does it end?
No, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, I think it's why the whole Polish MiG thing, it looks kind of stupid. You know, no one wants to be the one holding the hot potato that gives the jet to Poland because yeah. then it gives the jet to Ukraine because then they're subject to Russian reciprocation. But it's all about trying to avoid needless escalation.
Yep.
Because that's because escalate. I mean, it's one thing if escalation results in you crushing the other side and winning outright. That's no big deal. But when nukes are on the table, escalation has serious consequences. So
and here's the other thing people don't think about when it comes to escalation. Part of what could happen is that everybody's talking about Putin needs an off ramp. At some point, Biden might need an off ramp. I mean, We could mess up into a situation where Biden feels like his legacy and career is in jeopardy because he looks like a wimp, right? Because if, you know, it's possible that Russia could do something to an American, that Biden, that everyone would be like, what are you going to do, Biden? Are you a wimp? Are you going to, so this thing becomes very tricky and very dangerous. And it's hard for Biden to say we'll give you this, but we won't give you that. But that's what's, you know, life is complex. And so I am supporting at this moment the very difficult thing Biden's trying to do.
So to bring this back to political realignment, Josh, I don't know how to pronounce his last name properly.
I'm going to say Krausar.
Okay.
But I'll also accept Krausar.
Okay. he had a piece at the National Journal saying this was, this is going to strengthen, the internationalists, the interventionists in both parties, essentially the centrists, and marginalize those on the edges, including Trump. And you had a piece similarly at Daily Beast saying this is terrible for the America Firsters. I don't think that's necessarily wrong, but what I wrote was less declarative because I don't know how well this is all going to go. I mean, right now you do have great bipartisanship. I mean, the Ukraine package, aid package passed with barely a blip. All the sticking points were things unrelated to the Ukraine aid. It was all the other stuff. And even that didn't really get in the way. Democrats jettisoned COVID funding, just said, forget it. Because getting the rest of the budget and the Ukraine package done took priority. So you have that broad consensus. Even Trump is having to change his tune. Tucker Carlson is having to change his tune in some respect. I mean, now that they've completely flipped, but there's a tonal shift with both of them.
Yeah.
But what if this war doesn't go well?
Yeah.
What if we get too deep in and people don't like it? What if just Russia just wins outright? Oh, what if Ukraine accepts a peace agreement that is not favorable to Ukraine and makes them subject to Russian domination? Do the isolationist forces in both parties get louder and say, what was the point of all this?
Yeah.
Why should we have gotten tangled up in all of this? So I can't discount the possibility that the America Firsters are going to have, a resurgence. So much is on Biden's shoulders to execute. Yeah. Like Afghanistan, like a lot of people want to get out of Afghanistan, then got mad at how it went down. And in this case, Biden's in even less control over how well this is going to go. He doesn't hold all the cards. Russia holds cards. Ukraine holds cards. How well NATO is unified. It's been very unified up to this point, but there's points of tension still. He can't control what Germany does or France does or the UK does.
I think that's right. Obviously, it depends how it plays out. But I would say at this moment, the populist nationalists, isolationists are on their heels.
Yes.
Because, the situation has changed, obviously. And don't forget, a lot of these same people weren't just doves, but they were also pro Putin. They were saying even just go look at what Will Salatan over at The Bulwark went back and documented all of Nikki Haley's pronouncements in the last month about what Putin's going to do. And, they look so bad now at this moment. MAGA, America First looks so bad. And let me just, make a point about what Josh was saying specifically, because I had him on my podcast. We talked about this. When it comes to domestic politics, he actually doesn't think this is going to matter much in general elections. He thinks that, we've got we've got several very important Republican primaries in May. So, for example, in Ohio, J.D. Vance, who said, who cares what happens to Ukraine 6,000 miles away, how's that going to play?
He was struggling before this, though. It wasn't like he was the front runner and now it's going to be used to take him down a peg. He was always trailing Mandel.
Another one is North Carolina, where you have the Trump endorsed candidate was saying Trumpy things about Putin, about how brilliant he is, how savvy he is.
But another guy never a front runner, always been struggling.
That's a fair point. I mean, in fact, Trump's endorsed candidates, you can go to Arizona or Georgia, A lot of Trump's endorsed candidates were poised to lose. Mm-hmm. And that was already a story. Mm-hmm. But you could imagine it's going to be hard to prove that Ukraine contributed to this. But this is not helpful for Trump and for Trump's candidates at this moment. And I think that's what Josh was saying, that it will, it is having an impact right now.
So allow me to bring Romney into this. Cause there's a whole lot of, you know, Romney was right. You know, Obama said the 80s called, they want their foreign policy back, and Obama was naive, and Romney called it right by saying Putin was our number one geopolitical foe. So let's all apologize to Romney now.
Well, okay. Before you go there, because I think you're going to make some valid points, but I think it was a cheap. I think what Obama did was a cheap shot, and I think Romney got. And look, I was one of the foremost Romney critics in America. Mm-hmm. People probably forget this. People probably think I love Mitt Romney, or I always love Mitt Romney. I've gained respect for him in the Trump era, mm-hmm. but I was like one of Mitt Romney's harshest critics on the right. So I'm not like a Romney apologist, but the guy got screwed so much in that race against Obama, Candy Crowley. He's right in the main, but you know, like all that stuff. And then Obama, it was just such a cheap, scummy thing that Obama did in that moment.
I mean,
so
are we going to judge every, political jab that worked as being scummy? I mean, all sorts of things get said on the campaign trail.
I think Obama has a reputation for being like, he may not agree with him, but he's a thoughtful, nice guy, and he doesn't take, you know, cheap shots, and he took a lot of cheap shots in
Obama's a politician.
The war on women, binders full of women, Seamus on the roof of the car. Like, Obama ran a really shitty race against Mitt Romney.
Obama ran a harsh race against Romney, did not pull punches. I will certainly agree there were low blows in there. But Romney didn't run as an angel either. I mean, there's plenty of Romney low blows. In fact, I think one of the biggest ones, which I think is very relevant to this discussion here, is if you're assessing, was Romney right about Russia? Was he right that Putin was determined to reconstitute the Russian Empire? Yes, he was right about that, and he said that in his book in 2010, No Apology. So do you have Putin as a human being pegged? I'll give Romney credit for that, but that's like, you know, me in the bar saying, I told you Putin was a bad guy. I'm like, okay, buddy, good for you. What were you going to do about it? That's the tough part. And the thing that Romney hammered in the campaign and after the campaign was on missile defense, because Obama came in 2009. Bush had a missile defense plan to base a new system in Poland and the Czech Republic. And Obama came in and scrapped it. And Romney never forgave Obama for that and hammered him repeatedly in the campaign and afterwards, saying this was a gift to Putin. And what Romney always left out was that Obama replaced the Bush missile defense plan with his own, which Russia still didn't like. So that, to me, is an enormous cheap shot. And the difference was, and mind you, with Bush and Obama, the stated reason for the missiles defense system was not containing Russia, but Iran. And the Bush plan was going to focus on long-range missiles, where Bush's defense secretary, Robert Gates, carried over into Obama. And Gates recommended, you know what, we really need to focus on the short and medium-range missiles here, not the long-range.
Yeah.
So He endorsed shifting to a different type of system, which Obama announced right after the scrapping. I mean, it wasn't like he waited 6 years. Like, it was announced in 2009. And now what happened in 2012 was this hot mic moment, where we hear Obama go to Medvedev, who at this point was still the Russian president. Putin was nominally the prime minister at this point, saying, I forget the exact wording, but he said, you know, I will have more flexibility after the election. And Medvedev says, I will transmit this to Vladimir. So Romney, of course, hammers this. You know, again, you know, it's politics. I get him hammering that. It was unclear what Obama meant. And so you might as well see what hay you can make out of it. So I get that. But he was still hammering the point after the election, after it was clear that Obama was still moving ahead on missile defense. And Obama implements the system in 2016. Russia blows its stack, says it's a violation of the 1987 INF treaty, which it wasn't. And so to one, to your point now, I think this is just one of many examples I could give of Romney taking his own cheap shots. But more importantly, what we're trying to discern in this debate is, are there ways to deter violent imperialistic autocrats? Are there things that we could have done that we didn't do? And the things that Romney articulated in the 2012 campaign, which quite frankly were a lot, he didn't have like a 60-page white paper on it. He paints some very, very thin talking points, but it was, you know, missile defense. It was having a bigger budget, military budget than Russia. And it was fast tracking NATO admission for Ukraine as well as Georgia. And so on the missile defense and military budget fronts, my argument is, Obama did what you wanted to do, with the caveat of, in the military budget space, Romney said we got to maintain at least double Russia's military budget and spend 4% of GDP on it. Obama went down to 3% GDP from a little over 4, which is not what Romney wanted. Trump bumped that back up to 3.7%. Russia's is now a little over 4%. But you know, our GDP is immensely bigger than Russia's. So 10 years ago, our military budget was 18 times the size of Russia's, and now it's 12 times. So there's been a bit of a narrowing of the gap, but we still have a massively bigger military than Russia. So, and Romney just was saying we can't do any less than double. So like that metric was met. So So on those two fronts, I'd say we did what Romney wanted. Insufficient for deterrence. Now, the other point is admission of Ukraine into NATO. I mean, you argue, hey, if they were in NATO, maybe Putin would have thought twice because it would mean a direct military response. However, there's two things here. One, just because Romney wanted Ukraine in NATO doesn't mean Ukraine would have gotten in NATO, because it required unanimity amongst NATO nations. Bush proposed this in 2008, and at least 7 NATO countries said, we don't want to do that. We don't want to, it's going to provoke Russia, and we don't want to do that. And in 2010, Ukraine elects a pro-Russian president. And a poll at the time said only 20% of Ukrainians want into NATO. So if Romney's pushing this at a time when Ukraine doesn't want it and a good chunk of NATO doesn't want it, all you're doing is exposing division in NATO, which plays into Putin's hands. So the timing of that proposal was totally wrong. And even if you wanted to say, well, maybe Romney would be such an amazing leader that he would convince everybody to do this, who's to say that wouldn't just make Putin go, well, I guess I better go in now before this deal gets done? His whole thing was, we wouldn't renounce the possibility that Ukraine would go into NATO. Mind you, there were still European nations in February that were still against it. It was not imminent that they were going into NATO. And Putin uses as a pretext that, well, they're thinking about it, so I'm going to go in. So he could have still gone in anyway. I just don't see how what Romney was laying out there is a roadmap for deterrence, because you can act strong, but without allies, you're not strong. What Biden has done well to date is that he's kept a united front, because he hasn't proposed things that strain the alliance. And of course, it's easier now once the invasion happens, which was also true for Bush Sr. When the invasion happens, it's easier to have unanimity. And if you try to force the issue when the timing's not right, Putin might have gone in anyway, and we would have lacked, not only lacked the alliance that we've had, it might have been easier for Putin to shift the blame and say, hey, I'm just reacting to what you guys were doing, which, you know, Putin's trying now, but it's ridiculous. So he doesn't, he can't find the weak spot in the alliance. So I think in the case of Romney, I think it's an example of you can be too hawkish, too crudely hawkish, and miss the mark.
I think that's fair. And I think just as it's impossible to say what's going to happen in terms of American public policy as it pertains to the America First cause until we see how things shake out, you know, it's really difficult to say would have been better with Romney, or, you know, would things have been worse with Romney? Or, but I will say this, a few things. One, if you go back and read what Obama was saying, he was really playing this demagogic game of saying to Romney, like, you think Russia's this big deal. They're a joke. They're not relevant. They're weak. The real issue is Al-Qaeda.
Right.
And Romney was not saying that Al-Qaeda. Romney was saying the biggest geopolitical threat. And I think,
just to be clear, he said Russia was our number one geopolitical foe. And then he tried to pair that with Iran is our biggest geopolitical threat. So he recognized that the Russia thing seemed a little, you know, not in the moment.
But Obama was trying to say that's absurd because everyone knows Al-Qaeda's the number one.
Right.
Which I think Romney's understanding of the term geopolitical didn't apply to a non-state actor.
Sure.
And so I think that some of this is either a semantics issue or a matter of Obama sort of demagoguing at the time people were worried about Al-Qaeda and terrorism.
I don't think that was like the most sophisticated foreign policy analysis that Obama gave over the course of his presidency. He was trying to win an election. He found a weak. Romney's whole thing. Romney's book in 2010. It's a foreign policy book. He was trying to elevate foreign policy as an issue. He was and pushing this whole narrative that Obama's weak. He's on an apology tour again, talking about cheap shots.
This is where I want to go next, though.
Just so you finish this one point. Okay. So Ronnie was trying to make foreign policy the issue, and play upon the hawk dove narrative of the past several decades. So, you know, like, if I can make foreign policy the turf this campaign is based on, I'm in a stronger place if I'm making it on the economy. And this exchange happened in the foreign policy debate, and Obama can clearly a canned line, clearly a prepared line to make Romney look foolish on the turf that Romney wanted to claim.
Yeah.
And as far as the campaign was concerned, it worked. It put Romney on his heels.
It did work. I think that Obama... So what I'm arguing is that a president that goes into an administration with the assumption that Russia is dangerous and that Putin is evil is superior to an administration that goes in with the assumption that Russia is a backward, weak nation that we don't have to worry about. Now, missiles aside, what Obama did do, and I think arguably the thing that emboldened Putin the most was the red line in Syria, right? Says chemical weapons are our red line. Secretary of State John Kerry goes out and basically compares Assad to Hitler, and then we don't do anything. And then we let Russia, right, come in and kind of take over, essentially. Like, what kind of message does that send to Putin about our commitment to the international world and to honoring the lines that we've drawn? I mean, I think that Obama telegraphed to Putin a sign of weakness, and that Putin is a bully, and he's just going to take your lunch after that.
Well, let me partially agree with you. you look at, I mean, talking about sort of the reputations of the two parties, you know, we're in a hawk dove paradigm from roughly 72 to 2006, when the Iraq War becomes highly unpopular and Republicans lose that veneer of foreign policy competence. They lose the midterm election on the war. Obama wins the presidency. He wins the Democratic primary on, I was right about the stupid war and you other Democrats weren't. And he's able to best John McCain in a foreign policy debate because of Iraq.
Yeah. And then Donald Trump gets elected, attacking George W. Bush and the Iraq War.
In between those two points, you know, Obama's first term on foreign policy looks pretty good. He gets bin Laden. Not only do they have a seemingly successful military operation in Libya, you know, they get UN blessing, NATO operation, they take out Gaddafi, they stop a genocide. As part of the, you know, Russian reset, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, convinces Russia not to veto the Security Council resolution. This is a time when it's Medvedev as president, not Putin. And now we know that Putin was unhappy with Medvedev for doing that. You know, he's power behind the throne, but it wasn't, you know, 100% power, apparently, unless it was Putin playing some sort of like 12-dimensional chess where all the men would do a stupid thing and have a justification for coming back in. But from our vantage point in 2011, our diplomatic approach to Russia had some dividend, because they were, at that point, they were not playing the zero sum, if you're for it, we're against it game. We're going to allow America and NATO to play a policing effect over stopping genocide, you know, because we're communicating to Russia, hey, this is not about hegemonic power over you guys. This is not about getting in your business. We're just trying to stop a genocide here, and that's it. That seemed to be working. And then also Obama pulls out of Iraq, fulfilling a campaign promise, which in the moment looked positive. It's in the second term where this stuff doesn't pay off as readily. ISIS crops up in Iraq. Libya descends into civil war. Syria red line on top of Putin going into Crimea and seizing Crimea. So Obama ends the second term with unable to claim the foreign policy mantle for Democrats. It doesn't mean that Republicans get to take it back right away, because they've still discredited themselves. So we're in this sort of amorphous place where, like, you know, who's the strong and who's the weak is not clear. And of course, Hillary runs as someone more hawkish than Obama. And Putin becomes front and center in that discussion between Hillary and Trump in that debate. And I don't know if you quite say that Trump wins that debate, because in the exit poll, the question, who do you trust more in foreign policy? Hillary wins that by a lot. It just wasn't that many voters that were as their criteria. And then Trump gets in there and, you know, makes a mess of everything. And Biden gets in there. So to your point, I'm sure it's in the mix, not just because of Obama, but Trump as well. And not to mention Bush before Obama. Putin went into Georgia under Bush's watch and Bush didn't do anything. So we have a pattern of behavior where we're not checking Putin. I think there was more positives in Obama's approach than is given credit for. I think Libya's one. Iran nuclear deal Russia was part of. And I would argue the Iran deal was working until Trump screwed it up. So I don't think it's like a simple argument to say, well, Obama was an idiot for trying and Ronnie would have been much better. I think Ronnie would have missed. I mean, I agree Iran was a threat, so I want a deal to defuse that threat. If that meant working with a bunch of terrible people in Russia to get that deal, you know, that's life. You know, geopolitics is complicated. But I agree with you that all of these things probably fed Putin's notion that he could get away with this.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it means that if there are other things that we could have done that are more hawkish, it would have convinced him otherwise, because he just might have been hell-bent on doing it no matter what.
Makes sense, man. I'd love to keep going, but I got to, I got lunch with mom.
All right. I need to report back.
My aunt. This is going to be a great focus group.
All right. Where is she? You don't know where she is on Putin?
She's anti-Putin.
Okay.
Yeah, she's anti-Putin. Yeah. She's not, she doesn't watch Fox News. Mm-hmm. So that's the key distinction in my opinion. So
what is she watching?
I mean, she'll watch like the Today Show or, mm-hmm. you know, Good Morning America or, mm-hmm. or Willie, whatever Willie Geist does on Sunday morning. You know.
All right. Well, always good to talk to you, Matt.
Always good talking to you, Bill Scheer. And you can follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. And stay tuned here in the DMZ for, you know, for more of this amazing, high quality, you know, geopolitical conversation.
If I didn't mention the piece I wrote about Romney was in the Washington Monthly, so that's up at the website now.
Check it out.
And would anything on your YouTube do it to plug?
No, but go to youtube.com/Matt Lewis and subscribe. And I did have this week Josh Krausar, the aforementioned Josh on the audio podcast, as well as Arthur Brooks back to talk about his new book, From Strength to Strength. We talked about how to be. It was really more of a therapy session for yours truly, but it's a great book about how to be happy and successful after midlife, your midlife crisis, so to speak. So check it out.
All right. I'll see you back in the DMZ soon.
All right. See you guys.
Take care.